versus Peabody Coal Company. Mr. Gary.
May it please the court. My name is James M. Gary. I'm counsel for the appellant John W. Wasson in this case. And Mr. Wasson appeals from the judgment on jury verdict, which was entered on March 20, 2007, and which awarded him $350,000, and from the district court's amended judgment on the issue of damages, which granted Peabody Coal Company's renewed motion for judgment as a matter of law, and which was entered on June 26, 2007. The amended judgment, of course, actually vacated the prior judgment, awarding Mr. Wasson $350,000 and awarded Mr. Wasson $965.62, all pursuant to FRCP 50B. Your Honor, one thing I wanted to, Your Honor, to give as a broad overview this morning is this. As has been outlined in the facts this court is aware of, as of the year 2000, Mr. Wasson had been seeking, by letter, as the testimony shows, the documents that explained to him how his royalty payments were calculated under the coal mining lease in question.
But before you get too much into that, there's about a 2.5-year period of time between the close of discovery and then when this case kind of comes back to life again after the power company is out and so on. And I think that was a significant consideration for the magistrate judge and the district court judge. If you had used that time to review what you had already received and to have attempted to pursue some kind of supplemental discovery, all of this last-minute activity that you complain about might not have happened. Now, we don't know. It's a counterfactual. But there's a long period of time, 2.5 years, and the mere fact that summary judgment is pending doesn't mean you get to ignore the rest of your case.
Your Honor, I mean, you are correct with regard to what you have just outlined. In the almost 2.5-year period, there was no discovery that was conducted in the case. The motions for summary were on all issues.
Sure.
And, of course, were filed after the close, and we had already gone through, the court may have noted, many battles with the defendants indicating that they absolutely would refuse to go forward with any discovery past the deadline.
You don't know that, though. I mean, you have to ask the court. Of course, litigation, you know, they're going to... Anyway, that was my thought about your discovery complaints. I mean, as to the merits of the district court's Rule 50 ruling, seemed to me the district court, as the judge is entitled to do, looked at the evidence as a whole and said it's just not there. So to take, for example, this selection of the price of $107.26, which you euphemistically say in your reply brief was, quote, certainly by far the healthiest price paid per ton during the time. I mean, this is coal that's $18 a ton. And it was an accounting adjustment that caused 107. That really undermines a great deal of your case right there.
Your Honor, let me explain. With regard to the documents that eventually, as the court has just indicated, perhaps we should have pushed on earlier but did not, nonetheless, our motion to compel that was eventually filed in this case attached all of the letters required under the rules that we had sent to the defendant Peabody, saying we have examined these documents you produced pursuant to discovery, and of course they have a
burden. Well, but you're back still on the discovery point, and there's a lot of discretion in the district courts, as you know, to manage discovery. So I'm just not sure. I just picked that one fact, which I think undermines quite seriously your damage calculations. There are others as well, whether it's the royalty payments. The district court reviews all of them in her opinion.
If I may, Your Honor, one of the things I'd like to say, Judge Wood, in response to your point, because I don't want to leave you hanging on that, is that we are forced in many ways to prove negatives with regard to Peabody in this case in terms of our burden of proving the underpaid royalty payments. I want the court to realize I don't think there's any issue with regard to any of the parties. The Mansell-Robinson report...
It's just a summary report. It's not original data.
But it's documents that our client was entitled to under the terms of his contract, requested many times, and finally got, and was actually the fundamental piece of evidence in this case. It was flawed. It was incomplete. It had numerous blank spaces that weren't filled in. Peabody even admitted it was flawed. So we're starting with a document that has blanks that we don't even have the information for. Hence, when we went and asked the district court for that motion to compel, and were told it's granted, get every piece of data and document, and this is a large corporation, Your Honor. The documents that we eventually saw were computerized records, and yet we still didn't get them for all the periods of time. And with regard to that issue, Your Honor, we're very respectfully, Mr. Wasson wants the court to hear the flip side, and that is, if, in fact, we are remiss in not pressing for discovery in the 2.5 years this case was locked on summary judgment motions, then surely we are entitled to have time to evaluate all the documents that we had asked for back in 2004, and we attached all of the letters to the court in our both motions for a continuance that we filed within a week of the trial date in this case, and surely Peabody has a burden, this coal company, to come forward, produce the computerized records that they have to show the calculations that are done for a report they offered, put together, and submitted to us as evidence of the correct royalty payments that we received. Now, of course, what they did is they recited the payments we actually received. Peabody said, we owe you no more. We filed the suit. 1 year later, Peabody shows up with $103,000. Said, I guess we made a little mistake there. Maybe we do owe you a little bit more. We press on. Peabody goes to trial in the liability phase after Judge Barker bifurcated the case and says, we did not violate the contract in this case. We owe them no more money. At that point in time, we go and get a verdict on the liability portion in that phase of the case and go into the damage trial, and now suddenly Peabody, 2.5 weeks apart, says, well, as a matter of fact, we do them a little bit more money. And they bring in the very polished Mr. Barbaro from Washington, D.C., who has all of these documents, comes in and says, let me explain, and I will say that he had a very profound and impression upon the court in this case. No question about it. Meticulous with regard to all of his data and entry. But that's the overriding point in our appeal. We did not have the benefit of all that data in advance.
But what you haven't told us, I mean, that was then at the trial. Now here it is, you know, May of 2008. I'm not clear, now that you've had much more time to look at all of that information, what was in there that was going to show that there were underpayments?
Here's what we found, Your Honor. We found forms that, and it's a part of our record, we found forms identified as SR-505 forms. They populated very quickly, if I may, Your Honor, because it is a bit confusing. The FERC Form 423 forms.
Those are the ones that go to the power company.
That's
because
right.
It's regulated by FERC, but it has non-FERC customers.
Exactly, but it does not contain the freight information. The flip side is, on the coal company side of the equation, they have SR-505s that we discovered in these thousands of pages that were produced. We had discovered, as we put very forthrightly in our memorandum, two of these early on and sought more in those letters that we wrote. We did not get them. We came back, made a motion to compel.
I still don't know exactly, you know, where is the evidence, you know, that they mined X number of tons and we only got paid for 90% of X of those tons. I mean,
We actually took it in between trials, Your Honor, and filed, the court may recall, the supplemental damage specification.
Yeah, but I found that not to be very, I mean, that was really just Mr. Wasson's estimates of this. It wasn't based on background data.
But, Your Honor, it was prepared, compiled, and filed, really remarkably, in a period of time of about a week and a half to two,
okay,
after this material had been dumped on him en masse and his counsel. And that's, frankly, Your Honor, just I would respectfully say was pretty remarkable to get it prepared at that point in time. We populated areas and fields, monthly periods, in the Mansell-Robinson report with the 14 new SR-505s that we had never had before. We found an SR-505 that we tendered in this case as Exhibit 27 that showed Peabody was actually, that we had multiple people in the chain of the invoice, Peabody to Peabody Coal Sales. And Peabody Coal Sales then sells to...
Where did the $7 a pound figure come from?
The 107. It was found in the records that were presented to us, Your Honor, just a couple of weeks before trial. We found a document that indicated that they had a coal sale that they charged $107 a ton for.
A ton, I'm sorry, not a pound.
Yeah.
And versus 19.
And you think that's real?
Peabody has not refuted it, Your Honor.
Yes, they have. They have a lengthy description of where that number came from in their brief.
But they don't argue that they did not pay that for a ton.
Well, they more or less do argue that. They say it was an accounting adjustment from a different month, and so that number actually represents a couple of different components, the price of the coal plus the accounting adjustment component.
It was
smooth. That's what I understand their explanation to be, anyway.
It was smooth and sophisticated, Your Honor, but in reality, is it much different from Mr. Wasson looking at it and saying, how is it that I can't, without information, and left in a void?
So you actually think coal has been sold at $107 a ton?
I believe that coal was sold at $107 a ton by virtue of however they manipulated their entry in the book. That's what they recorded. It's actually on, I need to correct something, Your Honor.
Who pays $107 for a ton of coal?
Well, for instance, Your Honor, we understand that when coal goes into certain markets outside of the utility markets, there are private markets and specialized steel companies that definitely can pay prices that are above certainly this $18, $19, and $22, which I might add has been the rate for over 20 years now.
Why would they have any incentive to get that much above the market? I mean, you can pick up the Wall Street Journal. These are commodities. Why would Alcoa or somebody, or why would any of the other kind of companies want to pay so much more?
Your Honor, in terms of spot market prices,
you're just winging it. Come on.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, your time has expired. Mr. Domeen?
May it please the Court, David Domeney on behalf of the Appellee Peabody Coal Company, first addressing the issue of the court's refusal to grant a continuance in this matter. Below and even at this late date, the plaintiff has not demonstrated that Peabody failed to fulfill any of its discovery obligations in this long case. As a matter of fact, Peabody went beyond what it was really required to do in the discovery phase. There was a one-year discovery phase that was extended. We produced documents, or we referenced documents in our interrogatory responses that were ready for production, voluminous documents covering what was then a 20-year period, claim period, that was subsequently reduced on a statute of limitations ruling at trial, but stood ready to produce all of these voluminous documents, the earned royalty reports, the invoices, et cetera. And the plaintiff chose not to review them during the discovery period. It was only well afterwards that the plaintiff contacted us and asked to review the documents after the close of discovery, and we voluntarily produced the documents at that time.
Now, would you agree that when this final order was given before the, the 3 weeks before the trial, that the request to include the things that Robinson relied on encompassed a slightly different set of documents than you thought that you, or somehow than had been presented before? Apparently there were some new things turned over at that time.
Maybe some new documents.
Well, that's what I said. Not 100%, but some of them were new.
Not a large volume, and it's really a red herring in this case, because the substance of their argument now is that, And they made this argument below, was that Mr. Wasson believed that in the original documents, the 100 boxes of documents that were in the warehouse all this period of time from the initial discovery, that there were perhaps new documents sprinkled between some of those months, new invoices, new earned royalty reports. And there's absolutely no evidence of that whatsoever. If the plaintiff could make a case that there was stonewalling and bad faith, and that new essential documents were produced at the last minute, it would be incumbent upon the plaintiff to actually point to what documents they're talking about, instead of speaking in vague generalities that we found some new documents or that there's some new documents that were produced. The fact of the matter is that the vast majority of the documents, and at that time, my co-counsel was actually in charge of that, was a Peabody attorney that was actually in charge of putting all those documents together. The vast majority of those documents I produced once again in response to the magistrate's ruling, and I made some additional inquiries for folks that were involved in the Mansell-Robinson report, which wasn't referenced at all in the initial discovery request. That was just referenced and the magistrate's subsequent order reopening discovery on the eve of trial.
Now, Mr. Robinson is whom?
Mr. Robinson is a land agent with Peabody Coal Company that had dealings with Mr. Wasson. He was kind of a point person. There's been a history of complaints for many, many years, a long history between Mr. Wasson and Peabody, and he was in, was basically the point person at that time dealing with Mr. Wasson. The folks that were involved in drafting what has been called the Mansell Robinson Report were folks in accounting that were closer to the royalty calculations back in St. Louis. They prepared the report, and Mansell Robinson delivered the report to Mr. Wasson, and it's been called the Mansell Robinson Report solely because that's where he got it.
He delivered it? Okay. Did he sign it?
No, he did not. So, you know, the one last thing I would point out on the plaintiff's main argument that the court erred in failing to grant the continuance is that the cases that they rely upon are very distinguishable. The Carbon County case, for instance, this court's precedent from 1987 involved a two-month discovery period in a complex commercial litigation case, not a one-year discovery period. And we have a you know, five-year period from the filing of complaint to trial, in essence. But the court also upheld the denial of the continuance in that case with only a two-month period. Moving on to some of the other issues, we believe that the district court got it absolutely 100% correct in its ruling, setting aside the jury verdict, a very detailed and well-reasoned opinion. You know, stepping back and looking at this case, you would think that it would really be a court case from the beginning, a summary judgment type resolution. What we have is a contract that sets out a royalty formula. So you would think that the approach in litigating a disagreement would be to take the factual inputs, and that should be undisputed, but take the factual inputs and apply it to the real royalty formula outlined in the contract.
Well, I'm trying to figure out, I mean, so as you know, sometimes numbers need interpretation. Sometimes there is more than just reading the so-called plain language and looking at the so-called plain numbers. And if I understand Mr. Wasson's theory, it's really that Peabody, which I guess is now Heritage, was hiding certain production from him, was claiming that some smaller number of tons was being shipped out, and that's all he was getting his royalties on, not the higher number that he imagined that he thinks is there.
That was a theory. In our view, that was a theory that was articulated on the fly during what was to be the liability phase of the trial. Just giving some more procedural context to this, in the years leading up to the trial, the plaintiff's theory had been based on the analysis of a single month FERC data report, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission report, submitted by a single one of Peabody's customers.
It's Indianapolis Power and Light.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what Mr. Wasson did was he looked at that 1 month of fuel price data and tried to back it out and reach a comparison between the price that Peabody reported for that same month. I believe it was August 99, and he viewed a discrepancy there, and he spoon-fed that to his accountant, Mr. Robert Swan, and asked him to testify about this. Okay, there were all sorts of problems with that theory, as we pointed out. Peabody's royalty calculations were based on the average price to all its customers, not just one customer, but customers that don't even report to FERC, for instance, Alcoa, which was buying coal at a lower price. So we challenged Mr. Swan's opinions pre-trial and again had the opportunity to voir dire during trial, and the judge threw out his opinions as defective under Federal Rule of Evidence 702. What we expected to happen at that time would be for Mr. Wasson to pick up the ball and attempt to testify about that theory as well, because after all, that was their theory of the case, and he had created it and fed it to his expert in the first place. But instead, we had an about-face with a, what I would describe, basically a stream-of-consciousness approach, just testifying about these myriad documents and insinuating that Peabody was stonewalling and speculating at great length. And all of our testimony at trial was originally going to rebut the FERC theory. At the end of the day, we just put on one witness in the liability phase and said, you know, no, we looked at this month and there wasn't a problem with it.
Now, in his reply brief, the plaintiff quotes from a document he submitted in which he talks about, look at pages 7 through 9, talking about all the new documents that were found in the boxes that were produced to him just, you know, a week or so before trial. And you said there weren't any, or that there were so-called new documents. So what should we think about that? I'm confused now.
If I said that was a misstatement, Your Honor.
I may have misunderstood you.
The vast majority of the documents were previously produced. As I mentioned before, I had co-counsel with the company handling the document production at that time several years ago. Okay? At the time we get, you know, just before trial when the magistrate reopened discovery, the scope of discovery was different in that the magistrate judge was focused on this Mansell Robinson report, which was prepared after the original royalty payments and wasn't something that was referenced in the original interrogatories that we were responding to. So I went to sources with the company that were involved in the preparation of that after-the-fact report and got some file information from them as well.
But so that was the new material.
From my standpoint,
identified as new material so they could look at it in that short interval of time they had?
The boxes were labeled and readily identified, you know, which box was in the original production and which box was not. But it was not much in the way of documents. And if I understand the plaintiff's position correctly at this point, it's more run-of-the-mill type core data that, like earned royalty reports, original invoices, that type of thing, that they're claiming now was not produced originally, and we just do not believe that that's credible. Those type of documents were in the original document production. They were sat in the warehouse all this time period. I essentially went back, got those documents back out, and reproduced.
How many documents were there, do you think?
Probably out of 25 to 30 bankers' boxes, maybe two boxes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Domini. So, thank Mr. Guerra, your time expired, but we'll give you another minute if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm grateful. Judge Posner, before I leave and face my client, I'm sure will be disappointed in me by not dealing better with your question about $107 coal. Let me please add that I know he's testified in this case that his father, who was in the coal business before him, got $45 many, many years ago for coal sold in Korea or actually shipped as far away as Tampa. Once it gets on the river, it's easy. It moves. And there's all kinds of markets where there's all kinds of prices. But that doesn't deal directly with your request about $107 coal. All I know is what Peabody has provided to us. Your Honor, you just heard Mr. Domini. You just heard Mr. Domini say to you, at least two boxes that we gave Mr. Wasson were new. We had over 1,400 copies, and that didn't include anything close to the scans that we were allowed to make, but this fanfold paper and a lot of these computer records could not be scanned. Over two boxes in a case that is absolutely critical and depends entirely on their documentation. You know, the questions this court very appropriately asked Mr. Domini with regard to, well, what about Was this fleshed out, or how about the numbers, or could you tell me how many boxes, things of that nature? A hearing, Your Honor, would have resolved it. A hearing to give us, whether a short delay in the trial or anything, to flesh through this issue in a case that totally depended on the documents. You know, the last thing I want to add, Your Honor, and I'm grateful for the extra time, is that with regard to...
Have you looked at what's in these boxes? I mean, yes. You know what's in the boxes?
We did, and that's why Mr. Watson's damage calculations during, between the two trials in this case, plummeted from a $9 million claim to a $3 million claim, actually reduced by $6 million.
So he looked at the boxes?
Yes.
So what's the problem?
Well, the problem is the court wouldn't allow us even to amend our claim and use the new data to show that we had a $3 million claim instead of a $9 million claim. We had to go back and stick with the number that we had to flesh through quickly right before this trial started. And that's a huge problem, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Gary and Mr. Domenico.